WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is all of it from home on WNYC. And as I said on the show, as we're doing the shows from home, open concept in an apartment, great for light, not great for when it storms outside. So guys, I'm literally under a blanket, so I'll see what I can do about this. Let's go. When Little Richard passed away earlier this year, obituaries described him often as flamboyant performer, or both as the king and queen of rock and roll. Revisiting his life and enduring legacy on popular music was a reminder that within music, there's always been a vein of gender nonconformity. It's there in Prince's tenor to his falsetto range, or Annie Lennox in a dark suit sporting a crew cut. In the book Glitter Up the Dark, How Pop Music Broke the Binary, author Sasha Geffen traces how gender nonconformity and queerness have been essential rather than exceptional to pop music throughout the 20th century and to the present. Sasha, welcome to All of It.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for having me.
So chapter one of the book is devoted to the Beatles. Why did you begin with the Beatles?
So obviously the Beatles are not by any means the beginning of pop music. But for me, as I was doing research, they marked a shift into a new form of mass culture and a new volume of fandom. They were the first band I noticed who had merch around their image. You could buy Beatles dolls, Beatles wigs. They had an urgency of fandom that I believe outpaced most of their predecessors. And they also very deliberately played with gender norms and made gender-breaking hairstyles and behaviors mainstream in a way that few artists had done so previously.
So one of the songs you highlight in this chapter is the Beatles' It Won't Be Long. We're going to play a clip of it, but what are we listening for?
I would listen to the vocal relationships between the members of the band, because those were modeled. This is an original song by the Beatles, but they did many covers at the time of Black American girl groups. So they were actually modeling their vocal relationships after women who were singing to each other in a very specific way. So this song, I think, is a great example of how they took these very gendered vocal relationships into their own songwriting.
Let's take a listen to It Won't Be Long from the Beatles.
It won't be long, yeah, 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 yeah.
Book you write about how the Beatles and Elvis Presley, as you quote, take and the culture, a culture on capitalism and music, by taking well-established cultural norms created by black people, feeding them through the throats of less talented white performers and pretending they were brand new, end quote. So how do the examples of both Elvis and the Beatles show how culture also repackages queerness in music to make it fit in with gender norms?
Well, both Elvis and the Beatles borrowed mannerisms from queer performers. I mean, the Beatles were specifically taught certain vocal mannerisms from Little Richard. Like, he met with them. He taught Paul and John how to do his iconic woo, which they do, you know, throughout those early records. And Elvis covered Big Mama Thornton, who was a queer woman. His version of Hound Dog became in some accounts, the definitive one, even though it was not an original recording, and the way that he sang it was also not his own invention. So you have these vocal mannerisms that originate in queer performers, and at the time, you know, queer Black performers, who were finding ways to express what couldn't really be said explicitly in recorded popular music. And then you have white performers who record executives saw could be exponentially better selling, taking those thrilling vocal tics and just redoing them, just recording the exact same kind of swoop and flow of those original voices and then selling them to legions of white teenagers.
My guest is Sasha Geffen. Their new book is called Glitter Up the Dark, How Pop Music Broke the Binary. So you have this chapter called, I love this, Whining is Gender Neutral. And in it you examine the punk whine. What does the punk whine refer to and how is it connected to queerness?
So the punk whine is a style of singing embodied by Peach Alley of the Buzzcocks, Polystyrene of X-Ray Specs, Sex Pistols, lots of other performers. It is kind of a high, nasally form of singing with, you know, very little vibrato. And it approaches a childlike register. And children don't have vocal difference yet, you know, like no matter what your gender is, when you're a kid, you sound pretty much the same as other kids your age. So the way I hear it, by approaching childlike vocal mannerisms, punk performers also tended to erase the difference between other singers of different genders and approach this middle androgynous space. And you know, Pete Shelley at the time in the 70s when the Buzzcocks were first getting popular was, he didn't explicitly identify as a certain sexuality, but he was pretty open about his queerness. He wore, you know, buttons from organizations fighting for gay rights in the UK. And Polystyrene in interviews said that when she was on stage, she felt sexless. She didn't feel like a man or a woman. She felt like she approach this middle space. So I hear in their vocal performances this yearning to kind of shed the more traditional markers of gender that appear in the voice and kind of engage in this middle space that had the potential for more expressiveness.
Well, let's listen to a track from that seminal band, the Buzzcocks, featuring the late Pete Shelley, died about a year and a half ago. This is called Why Can't I Touch It?
Well, it seems so real.
You know, in the early period of glam and punk, you write about people like Iggy Pop and Alex Cooper, who were very visual, eyeliner, sequin, you know, tights for Iggy. And then Lou Reed, on the other hand, who presented a version of queer rock that was very understated. What did reactions to these different expressions of gender at the time really tell us about the way people were allowed to bend the binary?
So I think all three of the performers that you mentioned were cis men who embraced a very abject representation of masculinity. None of them was really trying to be pretty or glamorous in the same way as maybe David Bowie was at the time. Or, you know, all of these performers took influence from Warhol superstars who were trans women living in New York. But they kind of borrowed those markers of eyeliner and women's clothing and bent it into something that seemed a little bit depraved. And, you know, it went hand in hand with very extreme stage performances. You know, in Iggy's case, he would get very intoxicated and throw up on his audience, or he would cut himself on stage. Alice Cooper you know, would slaughter animals live on stage. Just these very extreme, violent performances went hand in hand with the gender transgressions. So you kind of see how putting on eyeliner as a cis man was almost equivalent to performing literal violence on the self. Like, those two things went hand in hand. So it wasn't so much a form of glamorousness, even though all of these performers contributed to glam rock as a genre and a movement, but it was more of a debasing of the self using feminine markers.
There was a really beautiful picture about 5 or 6 years ago of Iggy Pop in this satin, long satin dress. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I'm not ashamed to wear a dress, like, quote, like a woman, because I don't think it's shameful to be a woman." Which strikes me as a sort of really kind of excellent statement. And a feminist statement as well. Does feminism come into this discussion?
I mean, I think it's harder to see Iggy in the 1970s as a feminist figure. Mm-hmm. Same with Lou Reed, just because their treatment of women was not exactly a model for good behavior. But I'm happy to embrace latter-day Iggy as a feminist contemporary. Mm-hmm. I think he's grown up a lot over the past few decades. I don't know. I have a chapter in the book that is specifically about feminist music, about women's music, that was contemporaneous to glam rock, but pretty separate mm-hmm. from it. So I think you see these two movements as being pretty distinct. Glam rock was performed largely by men, many of whom were queer, some of whom were maybe temporarily queer, like Bowie, mm-hmm. who later came out as a closet heterosexual. And I think you do see some feminist critiques of these men at the time, mm-hmm. and I think you see women's music emerging a few years after the start of glam rock as almost a counterpoint, as proof that women could produce their own records, could play rock and roll and folk and all kinds of other music without the input or labor of men.
My guest is Sasha Guffin. Their book is called Glitter Up the Dark, How Pop Music Broke the Binary. Can you tell our audience about Jane County?
Yes. Jane County was a proto-punk performer living in New York in the 1970s. And she claims that David Bowie not only borrowed, so to speak, her look for his glam persona, but also took little bits of songs that she shared with him early in his career. So she claims that songs like Gene Genie and other kind of really important seminal Bowie songs were kind of cannibalized from her own work. So she is someone who has not really gotten the same acclaim or the same superstardom as Bowie or Lou Reed or any of her other cis male contemporaries, but the way that she performed at the time and the way that she dressed and moved, I think, was hugely influential on that entire movement. And it's interesting, actually, to read contemporaneous reviews of music in New York City at the time, because she was a familiar name. I feel like she was more well-known in the 70s in New York than she is now. There's a great review of a LaBelle show where this baffled cis male reviewer says that, you know, after LaBelle, the next logical step for, you know, a performance on the stage of the Met is Jane County, as if, you know, LaBelle was so outrageous that the next, you know, logical performer would be an actual trans woman. And he introduces her name without any explanation, so it's kind of assumed that readers would know who she was, which I find really interesting because her name isn't really tossed around as much now when we talk about trans performers or glam performers. So she is someone who I think is a really pivotal figure in both glam and punk in New York who maybe doesn't get the credit she's due.
You have a lot of people in the book that a lot of people will know a lot about. Prince, for example. But I do feel like I have to ask you about MTV. I kind of have to.
Of course.
How do you view MTV within your thesis that pop music broke the binary? What was MTV's role?
So MTV started broadcasting music videos in the 80s. In the early 80s, this is when music videos became a mainstream phenomenon, you know, kind of taking over these simulated live performances that had been popular throughout the 70s, like on Top of the Pops and other similar shows. So instead of having performers on a stage either playing live or pretending to play live, you had these short films that had increasingly good production quality. And because they could only be 3 to 5 minutes long in most cases, and were essentially promotional material for the albums that these songs were taken from, they had to be very lurid and very exciting. They really had to catch the eye as well as the ear. So you have these heightened dream spaces being broadcast on TV. And in many cases, there were artists in the UK that were very popular on MTV, kind of crossing the Atlantic, just because the UK was foreign enough to be exciting and exotic almost to American audiences. Mm-hmm. So you have bands like Culture Club and Flock of Seagulls who were performing synthpop because synthesizers coincided with the rise of MTV. All of a sudden, these kind of alien-sounding machines were accessible to pop performers and popular. So you have artists who are putting on makeup and doing their hair really big and singing over these very artificial sounding instrumentals coming out of synthesizers, mm-hmm. and recording music videos that also take place in these artificial spaces. So that led to a lot of kind of quasi drag with, you know, Boy George and Annie Lennox of the Eurythmics wearing cross gender outfits and singing in different registers.
Yeah, I can tell you just from my experience going across the country, and also it brought it into living rooms and TVs of kids who might not have ever been exposed to it. That's actually just my
photo.
The name of the book is Glitter Up the Dark, How Pop Music Broke the Binary. It's by Sasha Geffen. Sasha, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Allison. It's been a pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.